Hello, all you Inklings, and welcome back to Catawampus Readings, the podcast where beginnings and introductions are taken apart, scrutinized, and put back together again, just to see how they tick. This month, we're taking a look at some of those classics from our old required reading lists, at least in part because I avoided it with great enthusiasm in my younger years. I asked some of you for suggestions on what books to read, and I got some really good responses. As we're limited somewhat by what's available at the library, I've settled on David Copperfield by Charles Dickens. Now, I feel I ought to include a disclaimer here. As with To Kill a Mockingbird, I have pretty consistently avoided anything written by Dickens, simply because I knew he wrote utterly depressing stories. Now, I'm not saying that Dickens wasn't a master wordsmith or that his stories aren't worth reading. Neither of those are true, and you probably know it for yourself. But rather, I'm saying that Dickens used the tool of attaching his readers emotionally to the protagonist quickly and deeply, and then put them through a metric ton of really bad stuff in order to make a point and motivate his readership to action. Dickens wrote not just to tell good stories, but also to encourage his readers to make certain necessary changes. You can look at any number of his books, Oliver Twist, Great Expectations, Nicholas Nickleby, and you can see this tool at work. He's pointing out the expectations and privileges, or lack thereof, in England's stratified social classes, illustrating 100 ways in which they could be, and were, misused and corrupted. Charles Dickens was a great man and a fantastic author. I will not contest that. But I don't like to read depressing stories. They make me hurt on the inside. Maybe that means I'm an utter wuss, and that's probably true. But I'm comfortable with the fact that I read for a specific purpose, and in general, those books don't serve that purpose. I read books to escape from this world, not to be exposed to its lowest and nastiest levels. All that said, I will do my utmost not to allow this bias, this expectation of depressive content, to affect my analysis of the text. For those of you who, like myself, avoided these books, let's break down what David Copperfield is all about. Here's the summary from the back of the book. David Copperfield is the story of a young man's adventures on his journey from an unhappy and impoverished childhood to the discovery of his vocation as a successful novelist. Among the gloriously vivid cast of characters he encounters are his tyrannical stepfather, Mr. Murdstone, his brilliant but ultimately unworthy school friend, James Steerforth, his formidable aunt, Betsy Trotwood, the eternally humble yet treacherous Uriah Heep, frivolous, enchanting Dora Spenlow, and the magnificently impecunious Wilkins Micawber, one of literature's great comic creations. In David Copperfield, the novel he described as his favorite child, Dickens drew revealingly on his own experiences to create one of the most exuberant and enduringly popular works, filled with tragedy and comedy in equal measure. You'll notice, I think, that out of this lengthy paragraph, there's only one sentence that actually describes what happens in the story. The rest is a list of characters, which, while entertaining, isn't very informative, and a description of why the physical book is worth owning. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that this and the previous two books we've covered go a long way toward convincing me that this is a pattern. Books that are old enough to be classics and popular enough to be on a required reading list are also likely to assume that everyone is already too familiar with the story for it to need a good summary. I don't think I need to say that I don't agree with this, but I'm gonna say it anyway. I don't think that any story is ever in a position where attracting new readers somehow becomes unnecessary. That, however, is a topic for another episode, and I'm gonna put it on my list right here and move on. So, now that we've covered all of that, let's say that the summary gets 3 out of 5 for being too long and not informative enough, and then move on to the story proper. David Copperfield by Charles Dickens. Chapter 1. I Am Born. Whether I shall turn out to be the hero of my own life, or whether that station will be held by anybody else, these pages must show. To begin my life with the beginning of my life, I record that I was born, as I have been informed and believe, on a Friday at 12 o'clock at night. It was remarked that the clock began to strike, and I began to cry, simultaneously. In consideration of the day and hour of my birth, I was declared by my nurse and by some sage women in the neighborhood, who had taken a lively interest in me several months before there was any possibility of our becoming personally acquainted, first, that I was destined to be unlucky in life, and secondly, that I was privileged to see ghosts and spirits, both of these gifts inevitably attaching, as they believed, to all unlucky infants of either gender born toward the small hours of a Friday night. I need say nothing here on the first head, because nothing can show better than my history whether that prediction was verified or falsified by the result. On the second branch of the question, I will only remark that unless I ran through that part of my inheritance while I was still a baby, I have not yet come into it. But I do not at all complain of having been kept out of this property, and if anybody else should be in the present enjoyment of it, he is heartily welcome to keep it. I was born with a caul, which was advertised for sale in the newspapers at the low price of 15 guineas. Whether seagoing people were short of money about that time, or were short of faith and preferred cork jackets, I don't know. All I know is that there was but one solitary bidding, and that was from an attorney connected with the bill-broking business, who offered £2 in cash and the balance in sherry, but declined to be guaranteed from drowning on any higher bargain. Consequently, the advertisement was withdrawn at a dead loss, for as to sherry, my poor dear mother's own sherry was in the market then, and 10 years afterwards the call was put up in a raffle down in our part of the country to 50 members at a half crown a head, the winner to spend 5 shillings. I was present myself, and I remember to have felt quite uncomfortable and confused at part of myself being disposed of in that way. The call was won, I recollect, by an old lady with a handbasket who, very reluctantly, produced from it the stipulated 5 shillings, all in halfpence, and 2 pence halfpenny short, as it took an immense time and a great waste of arithmetic to endeavor, without any effect, to prove to her. It is a fact, which will long be remembered as remarkable down there, that she never drowned, but died triumphantly in bed at 92. I have understood that it was, to the last, her proudest boast, that she never had been on the water in her life except upon a bridge, and that, over her tea, to which she was extremely partial, she, to the last, expressed her indignation at the impiety of mariners and others who had the presumption to go meandering about the world. It was in vain to represent to her that some conveniences, tea perhaps included, resulted from this objectionable practice. She always returned with greater emphasis, with the instinctive knowledge of the strength of her objection, "Let us have no meandering." Not to meander myself at present, I will get back to my birth. I was born at Blunderstone in Suffolk, or thereby, as they say in Scotland. I was a posthumous child. My father's eyes had closed upon the light of this world 6 months when mine were opened on it. There is something strange to me, even now, in the reflection that he never saw me, and something even stranger yet in the shadowy remembrance that I have of my first childish associations with his white gravestone in the churchyard, and of the indefinable compassion I used to feel for it lying out there alone in the dark night, when our little parlor was warm and bright with fire and candle, and the doors to our house, almost cruelly it seemed to me sometimes, bolted and locked against it. I think it's safe to say that our narrator, Mr. Copperfield, is looking back on his life from a later point in time than that which is discussed in these lines. It gives a sense of perspective and also of maturity, which we might not otherwise get from a narrator describing their own childhood. I'm also attracted by the sense of humor he brings to the story. I was born, so I'm told, and I believe, on a Friday. This serves a double purpose of letting us know that he's self-aware, and also that he's willing to admit when he doesn't have all the information. This establishes him as a trustworthy person. If you've taken a creative writing course at some point in your life, I'm sure you've heard that a first-person perspective will bring the reader closer to the story. It makes it more immediate, more impactful when we're close to the narrator as a person. It's the difference between the faceless, nameless narrator saying Aragorn picked up the egg and found it warm to the touch, and Katniss Everdeen rolling over in bed to find the space beside her cold and empty. By the very nature of its format, we can tell right off the bat that our main character, Mr. Copperfield, isn't going to die, which removes some of the pressure of expectation from the reader. It lowers the stakes by assuring us that the narrator, regardless of what's happening on this current page, won't perish before the end of the book, because he's the one that's telling us the story. Unless the narrator is dead, which, I mean, that does happen sometimes. In The Book Thief, the narrator is death himself, so there's never really any assurance that the main character will live through what happens in her story. Anyway, what I'm trying to get at is that who's telling the story, whose story is being told, and whether or not the story is in the past or present tense all affect not only how close the reader is to the narrator, but also what kind of pressure the author can use against the audience to create that uncertainty that keeps us turning the page. I'm going to give this introduction 4 out of 5 stars, not because it's done anything wrong, but rather because it does everything well, but not in an exceptional way. I'm satisfied with the construction of this beginning, and I'm interested to see what happens next, but I'm not, you know, frantic to turn the page. That's all I have for you this week. The random question of the day is, you're a knight, and your nemesis has turned your steed into something else. What was your steed before, and what is it now? Until next time, stay safe out there, my Inklings. I know things have been crazy, I know times are rough, but I promise you that everything will settle down again if we're just patient enough to wait for it. This has been your host, Inkfire, and you have been a marvelous audience. I'll see you on the other side. Thank you for listening to Catawampus Readings. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. If you're interested in supporting Catawampus Readings and would like early access to new episodes, you can sign up to donate monthly at patreon.com/inkfire. Special thanks to our patrons, Corvus, Valkyrie, and Barry Marie.